An Introduction to the Gospel of Mark was presented by Ryan Carroll on January 5, 2020, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Ryan Carroll. This recording is being made available to you by Gutenberg College, a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Ryan Carroll. I think I know a lot of you. For a few of you who I don't know by name, I've been coming to this church for several years. I'm a teacher. I teach sixth grade history and English in Cottage Grove. I'm excited to be here. My plan is to begin a series on the Gospel of Mark, and my goal is to take us 8 weeks into the series up until about early March, and then pass the baton off to the next teacher, and then I'll come back pick up where I left off. I'm hoping that where I leave off is in the middle of the gospel, but there's so much fun stuff in chapter one that we'll see how far we get. So that's my goal. I had a lot of chance over the past several years to think about the Bible, to study the Bible. I was given an opportunity to go away and do some extra schooling up at Regent College. Some of you were aware of that and even helped to support me in doing that. During the last several years, one of the things that I've become really quite interested in are the Gospels. And these stories about Jesus and that we have. And so in some ways, I wouldn't say that the Gospel of Mark in particular is my favorite. I don't know if I have a favorite, but I really like the Gospel of Mark. And today, what I hope to do is to get you oriented / interested in the gospel. I'm not going to jump into the text in detail today. That we'll hit that next week. Also, I do want to stop every so often and make sure you guys have an opportunity to ask questions. There's so much that could be said, so many things that I will say that assume a ton of things. And I want to give you that opportunity to ask questions, to push back, etc. That's good. All right. So why do I like the Gospels? One of the things that I was impressed upon me by a professor I had at Regent who always kept coming back to 1 John, the introduction to 1 John, and John, the apostle's introduction to his own letter by talking about the fact that he had been an eyewitness to Jesus, to the life that had been manifested. And he talks about how his hands had handled, how he had heard, how he had seen, how he had touched the substance of this person and this gospel. And it's a very sort of real human-to-human sort of connection that John had with Jesus. And I think we often lose this sense of connection. I know I do. We're so far removed from these events. We're so far removed from that time and place and that culture. But to sort of have the opportunity to pause and to be reminded, the story of Mark, the story of the gospel that we're going to unpack is coming to us from people who saw and touched and handled and sweated and slept with and hung out with and listened to and fell asleep on and ate with the master that we all follow. The one who feels so often distant, and yet through the story of the gospel narratives, I think that's, he comes close to us. We have, there's something powerful about story. Not only does story cause us to reflect in a way that expository explanation does not often do, but story also puts us into contact with the actual event itself. And we often, as listeners of stories, when someone stops to tell us a story and tell us how big that fish is and what happened when he fell out of the boat, or when I stepped off the porch and slammed my head into the side of my in-law's walkway, I'm going to sue them. Anyway, so... That story, you come into contact with that moment through story in a way that I think is profound. And so, I've come to really to sort of embrace and respect that about story and in particular the gospel narratives. One other sort of like brief. Sort of word about the power of story. I teach sixth graders, and I often tell people when I'm talking about what I do, I'm often telling people, I think I might be teaching kids that are a little on the young end for me. But there's one thing. When I walk into a room of sixth graders, as busy as they are, especially those boys, but as busy as they are and as like difficult as it is for them to sit still, one of the, I weep a lot, by the way, I cry. One of the things that I can do in any given moment is I can stop and I can tell them a story or read them a story, and boom, the room is like my captive audience. I can talk till I'm blue in the face about thesis statements and the history of Egypt and blah, blah, blah. And the kids are like, oh God, Mr. Kellick, and they're looking around, you know. But I start telling a story and you have a captive audience. And I think that is significant. We have four stories that have been preserved for us by individuals in history, in time, who had contact with Jesus, or those that had themselves been in contact with Jesus. And these stories help us, as I mentioned, unlike just an explanation of how great Jesus' life, death, and resurrection was for us and all the theological implications, story helps us come into contact with and wrestle with this individual who is the subject of those stories. And I really like that. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about that. Also, I think, a couple other things. Another thing I like about stories is, and we'll be doing a lot of this, is they force the reader to struggle a little bit more with interpreting them than, say, expository text, than, say, a letter of Paul. Obviously, letters of Paul are very difficult at times to understand, and we're at a far remove from all those things that help us to do that. But just as Jesus taught using story and parables, I think it is significant that the main access that we have to who Jesus was and what he did and what he said was in the vehicle and has been given to us in the vehicle of story. So there's a whole lot of question about how to interpret story faithfully, how not to overread story, how not to underread it, what implications you're drawing, et cetera, et cetera. And we'll have a chance to talk a lot about that. Those are things that I'm really interested and really excited about. Okay. So, Gospel of Mark. How many of you would say you know, like, one fact, one thing about the Gospel of Mark? Anyone know anything about the Gospel of Mark? Okay. Thank you, Ron. Okay. So, little bit of a sort of broad introduction to Mark. First of all, Mark, the Gospel of Mark, although it has always had a fairly secure place in the Christian canon, it has from very early on been sort of, its reception was a little bit more cool than some of the other Gospels were. And there potentially could be several reasons for that. One, Mark's Gospel has got is the shortest. It's also, it's Mark's style. His Greek is rough. Also, there's a question of apostolic pedigree. Who is this Mark? How is he connected to Jesus and the authorized witnesses? Also, what we know is that Mark was quoted a whole lot less than in early church history, a whole lot less than some of the other Gospels, in particular Matthew. Augustine, 4th, 5th century, thought so little of Mark that he called Mark the foot slave and the abbreviator of Matthew. This is perhaps due to the fact that 90% of Mark's material is also found in Matthew. Matthew's gospel is quite a bit more extended. You get a lot more of Jesus' words and his teaching in Matthew's gospel than you do in Mark's. And so what we find is from early on, Mark's gospel kind of becomes the stepchild, no offense to any stepchildren out there, of the four. And so what is also true is that we have at least no record of any commentaries written about the Gospel of Mark until the 6th century, and not another one until the 9th century. This is sort of like Mark's sort of place among the Gospels throughout a lot of church history up until the modern period when some German scholars in 1838, one German scholar in particular that led to some domino effect, decided and forcefully argued that Mark had actually, far from being the foot slave and the abbreviator of Matthew, that Mark, in fact, was and had been the first gospel of the three synoptics that had been written. And once that consensus was made in the 19th century, Mark has seen an incredible sort of resurgence in people being interested in it, writing about it, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and we can talk about that if you want. But that's a bit of sort of like, it's sort of history of how people have been looking at it and thinking about it broadly. I want to read the first verse of Mark. Feel free to open. I am only going to read the first verse today, and we'll get into the rest of chapter 1 next week. But I want to notice three specific things about verse 1, and I'm going to read it, and then I will note these things. So Mark chapter 1, verse 1. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Okay, so three things to notice here. Number one, we notice that the subject of the entire gospel is Jesus, the person of Jesus. And that seems rather obvious to us, like, no crap, Ryan, like, Jesus is the subject of the gospels. But it turns out that in a lot of sort of like historical scholarship, that There was a lot of work done to sort of like explain how the Gospels weren't actually about Jesus. They were more about the communities that they were coming, the writers were coming out of, and they were more like epistles, and they would make up stories about Jesus and what Jesus had to say in order to help people in their situation, in the community that where they were writing their Gospels, etc. And so that, as most of us would read and sort of like take away from the plain reading of the text, we get that the subject of the gospel is Jesus, and what the authors of the gospel are intending to do is to tell as fairly wide of an audience as possible about who this Jesus is and why he was the Messiah and what it means to be his disciple. But historical scholarship can be what it is, and unfortunately, a lot of it has taken a different track when it comes to understanding the purpose of the gospel being written. So number one, the subject of the gospel is Jesus. Number two, we notice that Mark uses the term gospel in verse one. He says, this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Matthew does not call his gospel a gospel. He calls his gospel a biblos, or a book. Could be translated account. Luke calls his gospel a narrative or narration. And so Mark is unique in that he's using the term gospel, it appears, to refer to potentially two things. We know that Paul, who was writing his epistles a lot earlier than Mark probably wrote his gospel. Paul was using the term gospel to refer to the oral presentation of the message of salvation and eternal life found in Jesus and all the things that went along with that. That was sort of like that term gospel got used as an umbrella term for all those important things about Jesus. But here, Mark may very well have that sort of term, or have that understanding of gospel in mind as well, but it also appears that he is calling his written witness about Jesus also in some way, shape, or form a gospel. And that's unique to Mark. As I mentioned, Luke and Matthew don't refer to their own writings as gospels. And the question is, when did the term sort of get attached to all four of these written accounts? And it appears as though Mark's use of the term gospel to refer to this written account of Jesus's life and ministry gets picked up and ultimately used, certainly by the second century, because we have folks like Justin Martyr, who was early to middle second century, referring to the Gospels, plural, to refer to these written witnesses about Jesus. And so it wasn't too long until all four of the Gospel accounts that we know of just get referred to as Gospels. That being said, there's a whole lot of question and a whole lot of ink that has been spilled over, well, were the Gospels, were they unique to the ancient world? Is there a genre of writing that we can liken them to? If you're interested in that, I can talk more about it. I'm not going to spend more time on that right now, but that is that. Okay. So the third thing that we notice from verse 1 is that there is in the text no ascription to an author. Often with Paul's letters, we have Paul introducing himself and naming himself in the body of the text that we have received in the manuscripts that we have. But Mark, like the other three Gospels, in the text itself, they are anonymous. And so some have speculated, like, well, the gospel writers saw themselves sort of in the being in the vein of the traditional Hebrew biblical writers who would never put their names on their own writings. You know, as you go into the Old Testament, you look at those documents, Moses isn't, you know, starting Exodus by saying, hey, by the way, Moses, that was me, I wrote the thing. And so we have four anonymous gospel texts in a sense. What also is true is that most of our oldest surviving manuscripts also do not contain named authors. Some do. 2nd, 3rd, 4th century. However, this does not necessarily mean that the original autograph, that is, the piece of paper that Mark put pen to and wrote out his gospel on, didn't come. It's not to say that those were anonymous. It is highly likely that at the very least, if the autographs didn't have names on them, it is certainly likely that those who were making copies early on of the gospel accounts, once they were written, to then circulate as widely as possible throughout the Roman Empire, it is most likely the case that the gospels would have had names attached to them, if not on the actual parchment itself. They would have had letters going out with them, or verbal, or the messengers who were taking them out to the various communities. They would have been passing along the information, hey, by the way, this is the gospel from so-and-so. It is very likely. And the reason is this. In our the gospel tradition, and in the book of Acts, in particular in the gospel of John and the book of Acts, Jesus makes a really big deal out of, at the end of his life, telling his disciples, listen, you are going to be my eyewitnesses because, and he's pulled together the 12 at the end of his life, and he says, you're going to be my eyewitnesses, and I'm going to send the Spirit so that he will help remind you of all the things that I said. But you're going to be my eyewitnesses because you have been with me from the beginning. And when in Acts 2, before Pentecost, Judas Iscariot is now already committed suicide. He's gone. They're down to 11. And Peter stands up among his brethren and he says, we got to choose another one. We've got to choose another one. We've got to get the number back up to 12. And the way in which they went about selecting that option was the criteria was that the individual also, like them, Peter says in Acts 2, had to be one who had been from the beginning with us and who had been from the beginning a witness to all the things that Jesus said and to his resurrection. So given that what Jesus appears to do is to create an authorizing body of men, in this case, who were authorized to witness about him, concerning him, and also, as we see later in Acts 15 and in Paul's epistle, specifically to the Galatians, this same body was very, very interested in making sure that the teaching that was being done was authorized, right? And so, given how important it was to Jesus that the sharing and proclaiming of the gospel that he brought, given how important it was that the criteria was that people who had been with him from the beginning were the people doing this, it makes sense to me all the more as to, even though we don't have a name attached to, in many cases, the manuscripts that we have, speaking to authorship, that it would have been likely that these definitely had names attached to them as they were going out in the first century. Now, along the way, we do have manuscripts, 3rd, 4th, 5th century and on, that do show up with, in Mark's case, either an abbreviated according to Mark or the gospel according to Mark. Our very oldest papyrus text does not have either one of those, but again, these are the things that have, you know, survived. We don't know what, you know, all of the originals might have looked like or what they had contained. So if that's true, if it was really important to Jesus and really important to the apostles that the primary witnessing that was being done at that time was being done by authorized tradents, by the apostles, the question comes to mind then, the very question that we have to ask is, who is Mark, right? Who is this guy? If you look at all of the lists of the 12 apostles that we get in the synoptic accounts and in Acts, they're not in John. There's not a list in John. There's no Mark. So who's this Mark? And why did the church very early on accept this witness to the life of Jesus and attach this name to this witness, a name in which we don't really know anything about this guy, right? Except for we know that he wasn't one of the original 12. Okay, that's the question I want to speak to right now, but I do want to pause for a second. Does anyone have any questions about anything? Anyone like to ask anything of what I've said so far? Yes.
So I have heard in the past the Gospel of Mark being associated to Peter.
Hey, you're stealing my thunder here.
Oh, yeah. Sorry.
No, that's good.
So I was just wondering if you had heard anything about that.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what I want to speak to right now. And I want to pause to see if there's anyone else who has any other questions about anything I've said just now, and then I'm going to answer that question, because that's a great question. Anyone else?
I've often wondered when they said the replacement had to be someone who was with us from the beginning. Mm-hmm. When was the beginning? Is it when Jesus started teaching, or when Jesus started his ministry as we have it here? Or
I don't know that Peter would have said it had to be on this day at this time, but my guess is that the beginning would have been anywhere from the time when after Jesus got baptized to when he collected those first disciples in the early part of his ministry, and how much time that beginning, you know, in terms of how much time actually elapsed, may not have been that long, but yes, certainly by the time of Jesus having come back out of the wilderness and beginning that sort of proclamation of the kingdom that he does in the Galilee area.
Acts says, beginning from the baptism of John until the day when he was taken up from
us. Yeah. Anyone else? Okay. So Kathy asked a really great question. So we have this gospel. It's been traditionally, it's been given the title, The Gospel According to Mark. Who is this Mark? And how and why, if Jesus and the apostles were so interested in kind of managing the testimony about Jesus, how is Mark potentially associated or not associated with that group? Okay, this is the part that of the talk that there's a lot of detail that I probably could give that you may not care about. And so I'm going to summarize as best I can, but I will stop and let you ask further questions about this. So Kathy is, you know, from my own reading and that sort of thing, and sort of growing up and hearing this, that yes, there is a connection here to Peter, and the question is what's the connection? How do we know about the connection? So the oldest evidence that we have of connecting the Gospel of Mark with Peter comes from a man named Papias. And Papias was, he grew up to be the bishop of Hierapolis, which is in modern-day Turkey, which is in what is now modern-day Turkey, not too far from Colossae, not too far from Laodicea. And Papias, our dates for him are somewhere along the range of 60 AD to about 130 AD. And Papias, his main work was called the Exposition of the Logia of the Lord, and it is likely that that work was written sometime in the early 2nd century. We know this because he quotes from a lot of the gospel work, including John and 1 John and Revelation, which John's gospel and Revelation, etc., are thought to be quite late in that 1st century. But we don't have his work extant still. That is, it is not a surviving work. What does survive of Papias's work and his testimony to these things is through a 4th century church historian named Eusebius. Eusebius, of the several folks who quote Papias, Eusebius quotes him the most, and we have the information that we have from Eusebius's work, the Ecclesial History, from the 4th century. So, what is it that that Eusebius tells us about what Papias knew in terms of the connection between Mark and Peter and this written gospel? So, what I want to do is, let me back up before. I got a couple quotes from Papias. Apparently, Papias was uniquely positioned later in his life, early in his life, at the crossroads of the ancient world to come into contact with people who had listened to two different sorts of folks. He had the opportunity to come into contact with people who had listened to the disciples themselves. And he also had opportunity to come into contact with people who had listened to the elders, that is, the early church fathers, who had themselves also been in contact with the original apostles. And so what Papias tells us is that let me read what we have from him. This is out of a book called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses, and it's a great book, and I can talk about it more later. But for now, there it is. Okay. So this is the first quote. I got two quotes I want to read you. Papias says, quoted by Eusebius, "I shall not hesitate also to put into properly ordered form for you everything I learned carefully in the past from the elders and noted down well, for the truth of which I vouch. For unlike most people, I did not enjoy those who have a great deal to say, but those who teach the truth. Nor did I enjoy those who recall someone else's statements or commandments, but rather those who remember the commandments given by the Lord to the faith and proceeding from the truth itself. And if by chance anyone has been in attendance on the elders should come my way," again, the elders are that second generation after the apostles, the generation directly following the apostles. If anyone had been in attendance on the elders, if any of those should come my way, I inquired about the words of the elders. That is, what according to the elders, Andrew or Peter had said, or Philip or Thomas or James or John or Matthew or any of the Lord's disciples. And whatever Aristion and the elder John, the Lord's disciples, were saying. For I did not think that information from books would profit me as much as information from a living and surviving voice. Okay, couple things before I read the second quote. So what do we have here? We have Papias telling us that he had been in a position to listen to two groups of people, the elders, as I mentioned, that is that second generation of church leaders, as well as who themselves had, or people who had heard the elders teach, and also people who had heard what Aristion and the elder John, the Lord's disciples, were saying. So there's two groups of Lord's disciples here. Number one, he tells us about Andrew, Peter, Philip, Thomas, James, John, Matthew, what those guys had said. But then he says, those guys being the Lord's disciples, but then he gives us two other names, Aristion and the elder John, who he also calls the Lord's disciples. But what he tells us about those two is that they had not, what he tells us about those two is that they were saying versus past tense said. And so what most people think or believe that Papias was essentially sort of doing here is he's explaining that the disciples, the original disciples that he mentioned in this excerpt are the ones who have already passed. The ones who have died, and any elder who had been in contact with them or person who had listened to the elders' teaching, he was interested in getting the information from them. But apparently at the time of Papias, the time that Papias is writing about, there were two other disciples of the Lord, and Aristion and John the Elder may or may not refer to original apostles of the 12, but we do know there were far more, there was a larger group of Lord's disciples, and even a larger group that would potentially have been from with him from the beginning. Obviously, they chose a couple of names that had not been one of the 12 in Acts 2. What's to say? Who's to say that there could not have been some others? But Papias uses the verb in the present tense, what these disciples were saying. And so what Bauckham, who wrote this book, and others argue is that it is likely that at the time that Papias is referring to, this earlier stage in his life, prior to writing, that those two disciples of the Lord were still around, still teaching, and he was getting in contact with people who had listened to them. And so so Papias is in this sort of like really very great position in the late part of the first century where he is growing up to have connection with the tradition and the teaching and the commands from people who had heard it firsthand from the Lord's disciples. So given that, I want to read one other quote that then helps us to understand the connection between Mark's gospel and Peter. Papias then is quoted by Eusebius later on as saying this, "The elder, that is John the elder, one of the two likely surviving disciples of Jesus, used to say, Mark, in his capacity as Peter's interpreter, wrote down accurately as many things as he, likely Peter, recalled from memory, though he did not do so in an ordered form of the things either said or done by the Lord. For he, likely Mark, neither heard the Lord nor accompanied him, but later, as I said, he heard and accompanied Peter, who used to give his teachings in the form of krei, short teachings about things that Jesus did or said, but had no intention, that is Mark, of providing an ordered arrangement of the logia, the statements, the words, the accounts of the Lord. Consequently, Mark did nothing wrong when he wrote down some individual items just as he, likely Peter, related them from memory. For he, Mark, made it his one concern not to omit anything he had heard or to falsify anything. So this is the earliest tradition that we have of the Gospel of Mark being attached to one of the apostles, and in particular to Peter. Later in the second century, Justin Martyr, as well as Irenaeus of Lyon, both of those two also, in separate works, ascribe similar relationship to the Gospel of Mark and Peter. Historians wonder whether or not Justin Martyr and Irenaeus are getting that information from Papias, or whether that is a separate sort of like information that they came across in other ways. But needless to say, that is how the sort of the primary way in which Peter himself got attached to this particular gospel. So if we take Papias at his word, and again, a lot of people don't want to for a lot of different reasons, but I don't see any good reason not to. And it seems in particular very odd that the early church would be willing to attach someone's name, especially someone who was mostly unknown. I mean, we can talk about what Mark may or may not have been, who he may or may not have been. But it would be very odd for them to make up a random Mark to just attach this gospel to, especially for something that was so significant as the testimony and eyewitness testimony of the Jesus story that they wanted to circulate. So I'll stop there. I have more to say, but any questions about that?
Do we know something about Peter's inability to write down his own information, or was it common to have, did these guys have scribes?
We don't know anything for sure. I mean, the speculation is that, it was not uncommon for people to have scribes or what was called an amanuensis. Paul himself likely had someone who was scribing things for him, at least at times. Whether Peter knew Greek well enough to be able to set down what he wanted to set down in Greek, the lingua franca of the world at that time, to get his story about Jesus out there, is part of that speculation. But we don't know for sure. Yeah. Any other questions?
This is actually just sort of tagging on to what you said. You said earlier that the idea was that Mark was Peter's translator.
Yeah, we're going to talk about what he might have meant in a second. But the word that Papias uses is hermeneutes, and you can take this a couple different way, but translator or interpreter is one possible way to take it.
So then I suppose if you took it that way, it would make it a lot more plausible that he was writing stuff down in Greek that Peter wouldn't have. But, I mean, if Peter wasn't, I don't know. That's kind of an odd thought. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, one option is that Peter has done his own writing and Mark is simply taking the Aramaic that Peter would have been writing in and translating it into Greek. Another option is that as an interpreter, he simply is referring to the process of listening and taking notes and putting into words, you know, putting into Greek what Peter's telling him. What we do know, and Papias is very keen to be clear about it, and such that people have speculated, is Papias trying to, was there something about Mark's gospel that he was wanting to champion such that people were denigrating it? Why is he taking the time to like tell us exactly that that Mark translated faithfully everything Peter said, did not add anything or take anything away from? So, question back there.
I'm wondering why would have if this is Peter's testimony and the Christian world was familiar with Peter, why would Mark's name get put on it and not it be like, you know, why would, like, usually, you know, if you write a book and a ghostwriter is working with you, like, the name that is known is the name that gets put on the letter. Like, why would Mark's name get attached to it then and not Peter's?
That's a great, I mean, it's a good question. I don't have like a great answer to it. What we do know is this, like we know Luke was not an apostle, but Luke tells us at the beginning of his gospel that he spent time, a lot of time, with those who had been with Jesus from the beginning. And such that he had worked it all out and that he felt that he had, he doesn't say that he was authorized, but he felt like he had understood well enough after having spent time doing his research and spending time with the people who had been there from the beginning that he could write this gospel, and those powers that be had basically authorized him to do so. Probably. So there wasn't a problem with the gospel text itself. There wasn't a problem with these texts out there with other people's names on them. And again, how those names first got attached and when, and for example, when Mark's gospel went out and started circulating, when that messenger went with it to deliver it and share, etc., what got said, what, you know, in terms of the relationship between the person who was writing and Peter himself and that sort of thing. So those things have been kind of lost in history to us. But it's a good question. I'm not sure if I answered it very well, but up here, I'll take one more question and then I want to zoom forward here.
So, I don't know if this is the appropriate time to ask this question, but I'm going to forge ahead.
Good.
Did you find in your research any relationship between Peter's other two letters and Mark's gospel? Is there any kind of repeated phrases or any kind of relationship at all? Because we have, you know, his name is attached to the First and Second Peter.
Right. What you don't have in First and Second Peter is any comment from the author, and we'll just call him Peter, and I don't have any reason to not believe it was Peter. You don't have any comment about a gospel that he wrote or any other works of writing that he did. First and Second Peter are so specific to the situation and the mission of Peter and the people he's writing to. It's so different from this narrative about the life of Jesus. And so, like in First John, where you do get some echoes of the gospel in the way in which John writes his epistle, I don't think you have that in First and Second Peter. I have not studied First and Second Peter much at all, but I don't think you have that there. Peter there may be a statement about, similar to John's, about his connection to what he, to Jesus, but I don't, I'm drawing a blank right now. So anyway, yeah. Okay. So, this is going to be the more fun part of the talk here. So if Papias is correct, and I have no reason to question that at this point, it brings some questions up. First of all, like, what is the relationship that Peter had to the text itself? What is the relationship that Mark had to the text? To what extent did Mark simply, as Papias asserts, just write down exactly what Peter told him? To what extent did, as Papias asserts, did Mark not, quote, order the material? To what extent is, do we see Peter's experience reflected in the gospel? So these are all good questions. And I want to just say from the outset that I think, given what we know, given all that I've said, that what we have in Mark is a work of highly reflective material that has been ordered and structured in a particular way that does not, to me, seem at all to be this unordered sort of like throwing together of material as Papias's excerpt leads us to believe that it is. So that's the first thing, and I'm going to talk more about that. I also think that we need to therefore take Papias' connection to this gospel, to Peter, very seriously. And so even though I'm going to, because of force of habit, I'm going to talk about Mark and what Mark did and how Mark wrote, and it's just going to happen, I do believe that what we have in this gospel, and from the ordering of the material, from the reflection that is inherent in the material, what I believe that we have Peter's testimony behind it. And to ask and sort of like push the envelope a little bit further, the question is, well, where did Peter come up with this? And it seems most likely to me that Peter's own testimony would have been not only shaped by his own sense experience and his relationship to Jesus and all the things that he went through vis-a-vis Jesus, but that the gospel text that we have in Mark is itself a reflection and goes back to Jesus himself. That it is highly likely that what we have is the time spent between Jesus and Peter post-resurrection, as Jesus mentions the helper that he's going to send that is going to provide insight and remind them of all the things that he said and did, etc., that we understand that Mark is not just this, you know, we don't have just this random guy Mark. What we have is what we have in this text is connection back to Jesus himself and Peter's testimony. So I think that's true. A lot of people, especially in the academy, don't think that's so true. But that's okay. Yeah. So, okay, I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the gospel. So if Papias is like, hey, this thing is not ordered, he's just getting snippets and he's sticking them together, albeit they're snippets directly from Peter and he's not falsifying anything that Peter said, I don't think that's right. I think that Mark shows us evidence of being well-structured and ordered, and I want to talk about that a little bit. First of all, if Mark was the first of the Gospels, we see evidence of the overall structure that Peter chose to give the narrative about Jesus. We see evidence of that structure being used by Matthew and by Luke. That structure is this, different from John, where John's Jesus is continuously making trip to Jerusalem for the feasts, and most of the material in the Gospel of John are signs and conflicts that he has with religious Pharisees, Jews in Jerusalem. Not all, but a good chunk. What we have in Mark is Jesus only going to Jerusalem once. Beginning of his ministry, he gets baptized in the wilderness, and then after he himself spends 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, you've got this Galilean ministry that takes up 8-9 chapters of the Gospel of Mark. So Jesus stays in the Galilee, he's moving around a lot, and then after those 8 or 9 chapters, you've got this Mount of Transfiguration. After the Mount of Transfiguration, you have Jesus on the way to Jerusalem, and then, and only once, unlike John, you have Jesus on the way to Jerusalem for Passover, the last week of his life. You've got the various conflicts that arose when he came into Jerusalem, and then you ultimately have his deliverance over to the religious rulers, to Pilate, his death, and then you sort of have his resurrection in Mark, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit. So that structure, that overall structure of Galilean ministry, on the way to Jerusalem, Jerusalem the last week of his life, that is the same structure that it gets adopted by Matthew and Luke as well. Now, that by itself leads us to the conclusion that at least in some way, Mark has, unlike Papias's assertion, Mark is at least in some way providing us with a text, a narrative that has a fairly like decent progression to it. He's not just ad hoc throwing like the text about Jesus's death like into the middle of his narrative. It seems to be ordered in a way that moves the reader and understands that Jesus's ministry is progressing and then he's moving off and ultimately doing what he does in Jerusalem. So there he's got that going for him, and that's great. What else do we see in terms of Mark's literary ordering? Couple things. Mark does something that other gospels do a little bit, but he does a little bit more, and that is he groups like material together. For example, in chapter 2 and chapter 3, he brings together 4 conflict stories that Jesus has with the religious rulers, and he brings those all together, and they're like boom, 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 conflict, 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 conflict. It's pretty evident that those stories are indicative of the kind of things that Jesus, the kind of conflict that Jesus was having with the religious rulers. Did they all happen together like that in actual time, in real time? Probably not, but Mark has brought them together. He's grouped them. Another grouping that you have in Mark's gospel is a set of parables. So chapter 4, all of the parables that Mark tells about the kingdom in the entire gospel are there in chapter 4. A lot fewer parables in Mark than any of the other 2 synoptic gospels, and they all the kingdom parables are all there together in chapter 4. Did Jesus rattle them off right there in real time? Probably not, but Mark's grouped them. Then, after chapter 4, you've got chapter 5 and 6, end of chapter 4 through chapter 6, where you've got a bank of mighty deeds and miraculous healings. So it goes conflict stories, parables, mighty deeds, miraculous healings. And there's like little bits that separate those things. And we'll talk more as we get into the text. But he's brought these mighty deeds together. And he's put them right after the parables. And one of the interesting things is that on the heels of the parables, Mark's disciples are like, okay, we're in. You're telling us the interpretation of these parables. And then it's like, we get what's going on. And then Jesus does all these mighty deeds. And they're like, who is this guy? Like, what's going on? So anyway, we'll talk more about that. But so section of conflict stories, section of parables, section of mighty deeds. Another thing that Mark does that is really quite cool that speaks to this literary ordering. Mark is the only one who includes two feeding miracles. You've got the feeding of the 5,000, but then in chapter 6, but then in chapter 8 you have the feeding of the 4,000. And in both cases, like, the disciples come to Jesus, are like, dude, there's all these people, they're waiting for you, we're out in this desolate place, we got to do something. Chapter 6, well, you do something, we don't know what to do. What food do you have? Bring it to me. So he does this in chapter 6. He feeds 5,000. They collect the 12 baskets full of fragments left over. And his disciples are like, oh, okay, like, that's great. And then two chapters later, they're doing it again. Hey, Jesus, there's a lot of people following you. It was a desolate place. What are we doing? Jesus is looking at them like, what did we do the last time, idiots? And they're like, what do we, he said, how much bread you got? So they bring him 7 loaves. This time there's 7 baskets full left over. At the end of these two feedings, right, they're like directly at the end, Jesus like looking at them saying, do you not understand? And they're like, no, we don't. And right on the heels of that, Mark inserts this moment where Jesus heals a blind man. But he doesn't heal him in sort of the normal way. It takes Jesus 2 touches to heal this guy. Jesus touches him the first time, and the guy's like, I kind of see people looking like trees, or I don't remember exactly what it says. And then he touches them a second time, and the guy sees clearly. Okay, so you've got these 2 miracles. Disciples are like, we don't get it. And then you've got this blind man that needs 2 touches. And then you've got Jesus, so Mark, again, this is Mark's ordering of the material. Then you've got Jesus sitting his disciples down saying, who do the people say that I am? And you guys know this very well. And Peter finally says, hey, for the first time, this is the first time in Mark's gospel where a human being declares that he's the Messiah. He's like, you're the Messiah. And Jesus is like, yes, I am. And I'm going to suffer and die, and I'm going to rise again. And Peter's like, no, you're not. And he then gets called Satan. And so then it sort of like begs a question. Have the disciples really understood? Okay, 2 feedings, 2 touches on the blind man. Here's Peter. Yes, you get it. No, you don't get it. So Jesus 3 times then on the way to Jerusalem says, I'm going to die. I'm going to suffer. And all 3 times, his disciples are like, no, we don't get it. Who's the greatest? Hey, you're John, you should sit on his throne. It's going to be awesome. Anyway, right before he gets to Jerusalem, there's another blind man. Who knows who this blind man is? Bartimaeus. Thank you. And Bartimaeus gets healed. Jesus, son of David, have mercy on me. And Jesus doesn't touch him. Just heals them. And so it's like, okay, there's these puzzles. Mark is ordering his material. This is all very interesting, and we're going to talk a lot more about it. But is this the throwing together like moments in time that Papias is sort of like saying that Mark did of Peter's teaching? It doesn't feel like that. There's some other things that Mark does that we'll talk more about later. But just to make sure you come back next week, I've got some exciting things that I want to tell you about. So I talked a little bit about the structure. I want to talk a little bit about the content. Why does Mark matter to me? Why is it interesting to me? Because first of all, I like Mark because there's a lot of puzzles in Mark. Peter captures, see how that works. Mark's text provides the reader with a lot of puzzles to wrestle with. And some examples of those puzzles that I'm looking forward to unpacking with you all. Mark's text, Mark's gospel, is very famous for this notion of the messianic secret, where Jesus is constantly hushing everyone around him to tell no one about who he is, and he's hushing the demons, and he's hushing the leper that he heals, and all these things. And then every once in a while, he like says, okay, you go proclaim, but not you. And so what's going on with this hushing? Why is he wanting this to be the case? This is a puzzle. At the very beginning of his ministry, he comes up out of the water being baptized by John, the voice from heaven, and then it says the Holy Spirit ekbaloed him into the wilderness. And literally, it's like spit him or threw him into the wilderness. And he's there for 40 days and 40 nights. What's he doing? What is this? Why does Jesus start his ministry this way? Why does God want Jesus to start his ministry this way? This is a good puzzle. Does Jesus affirm the law in its entirety or not? Mark brings this question up to us, and this is one that we'll discuss. Also, the nature of discipleship. Very early on in Mark's gospel is the question of who's in, who knows, and who's out. And Jesus brings his disciples together, and he says, "You guys have been given the mystery of the kingdom. And all these other people out here, they don't get it. They're outside, and I'm speaking to them in parables." And the disciples are like, okay, we get the mystery of the kingdom. Of course, they have no idea what he's talking about. And the rest, like, time and again along in the text, the question, the puzzle is, who really knows who this man is? Who really gets the Messiah's agenda? Because even, as we all know, up to the very end of his life, the dude's alone. He's got no one with him anymore. No one seems to be on the in. No one seems to understand the mystery of the kingdom. This Messiah who says he's going to get rejected and die, like, no thanks. And at the very end of the Gospel of Mark, you've got this incredible statement by a Gentile Roman centurion that mimics the statement that Mark makes about Jesus in the beginning, the Messiah, who is the Son of God, the one human being who calls Jesus the Son of God in the text is this Roman centurion after he watches Jesus die. Truly, this man was the Son of God. So it brings up all these questions and puzzles about what people know and why and how do they understand and what their understanding of being a Messiah is. Temple veil is torn in two from top to bottom. This is a puzzle. Why does this happen? There's lots of conversation about the kingdom of God. The kingdom of God is here, it's now, and it doesn't appear to be here and now. And what's going on with the kingdom of God? These are puzzles that we're going to talk about. For all the miracles that Jesus performs in Galilee, like in John, you got 7 miracles. And in Mark, you've got like tons of miracles. You've got like the ones that he writes about, but then you get these sections that says, and like people were running around the whole region and throwing sick people in front of him and hoping they can touch his cloak, and thousands of them were getting like healed. And all these miracles, right? And of course, he gets to Jerusalem, and the only miracle he performs while he's in Jerusalem is destroying a fig tree, like withering it from the roots up. What's up with that? Mark's gospel, also puzzling, does not contain any resurrection appearances. We have our best manuscripts stop the gospel at the point in which the angel in the tomb says, go tell it to the women, go tell Peter and the disciples that he is risen and he's going before them into Galilee, and that's where he's going to meet him. And the gospel ends with the women like leaving terrified and not like, blah. And this is the end of the gospel, right? So like, what is that all about? Why is Peter/Mark, why did they choose to end it that way? Are we missing an ending? It is very obvious, and we'll talk more about it like in 3 years when I get to the end of this thing. why we're so sure that the end of the gospel that we have of Mark is not the original text. But anyway, love these puzzles, right? So Mark is really good for puzzles. Anyway, I am really interested with, I'm looking forward to this. I feel like one of the things that, another question that that I have of the text that we're going to be talking some about is this ordering of material and how Peter/Mark is ordering material and whether or not there is some larger schema or framework that stands behind the ordering of material. I had a professor at Regent whose whole dissertation, PhD dissertation at Cambridge was about looking specifically at what Mark's greater theological schema was and trying to show exactly how that worked out and mapped out in the way that he wrote his narrative. The question is that legitimate? Is it not legitimate? At the end of the day, we'll be talking a lot about that. I think that he builds a bridge slightly too far, but it does cause us the questions about how we interpret narrative and all that kind of come to the fore. And so I'll look forward to discussing those as well. So next week, we're going to jump into chapter 1. Lots of good things in chapter 1, including, but not limited to, how does Isaiah fitting into this? Mark attaches the beginning of this gospel to Isaiah. We've got the question about what John the Baptist was doing, why Jesus came to John, why Jesus gets sent out into the wilderness, and then ultimately, we've got our introduction to the proclamation of the kingdom of God and that we'll be talking a lot about. So I would love to have you back next week. We have like a minute or two. Does anyone have any questions they want to throw out at this point?
Okay. So I just would like your opinion. I've heard from other sources that it's possible that Mark was the first gospel written because it's the shortest, based upon the assumption that when you write something, the first time you write it, it's more natural to write a shorter article or shorter document, and then more natural to build on it as time progresses, which I've heard that both Matthew and Luke may have used Mark's gospel as the pattern or as the first building block for their gospels. Mm-hmm. So I'm just wondering what your opinion would be on that. Is it likely Mark's Gospels, the first of the Gospels written, and how likely is it that Mark and Luke, Matthew and Luke, used Mark?
Great questions. I do think it's highly likely that Mark was the first, and people have a lot of reasons for talking about why that is, but I do think that's true. What's interesting is with the because as you allude to the synoptic, the people who deal with this synoptic question of what the relationship is between these gospels, they call the material that all three of the synoptics share the triple tradition. That is the material that is found in all three of the synoptic gospels. And three quarters of Mark is part of that triple tradition. So it's very clear that they're sharing a source at least. But what for a long time was believed is that Matthew was the primary one. Matthew was the one that everyone was that sort of was the basis for that. because it was the longer one and that sort of thing, and Mark was abbreviating and that sort of thing. But when you look at the individual, what they call pericopes, the individual chunks, stories that have been sewn into the narrative, the ones that get borrowed from Mark by Matthew and Luke, Mark's account is actually longer for those particular pericopes than the ones that you see in Luke and Matthew. So in fact, what Luke and Matthew seem to be doing is actually abbreviating what Mark had into their own material, which is one reason, again, among many, in which as to why they believe that it was in fact Matthew and Luke that were borrowing the material from Mark and not the other way around. So, did I answer your question? Okay. All right. I've kept you. Have a good night. Thank you so much. I'm happy to... Oh, also, I'm going to send out my email. If you have any questions, love to have you email. Feel free to come up. Thank you very much.